Welcome to Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November the 27th, 2017. As always, Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and by La Scalzo Institute, a Kaplan company. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be talking to you this week about some of the things that have gone on in federal taxes. For the first time in a few weeks, we're not going to spend the whole podcast talking about what went on with H.R. 1, which is the bill to have comprehensive tax reform, or at least that's what we're calling it these days. And we'll talk about a little bit more about what went on this week in that area, but Congress was not in session this week. So I'm going to talk some about where we stand with the bill. Also want to discuss one provision that I hadn't mentioned last week. I think we're going to keep discovering things as we look further at this bill that we may want to talk about some more as they come up. But a provision in the Senate bill, particularly I want to bring up from the discussion that we've had in the past. I want to add one more thing there so some of you are aware this is in there. We also talked about some regular developments this week. We'll talk about the IRS ruling a taxpayer did not have cancellation of debt income when it was determined he didn't have to pay back an overpayment from pension funds. The IRS not unexpectedly extended the qualified plan relief provisions for the hurricanes to cover the victims of the California wildfires. We talk about a case where a taxpayer tried to get a little creative on generating a loss using a planning technique that we see quite a bit in the context of estate planning. Turns out in the context of income tax planning, this didn't work quite as well. We also have another S-corporation problem. This is where shareholders got in trouble with loans from a related company and attempting to use those for basis didn't work. And finally, we're going to discuss the IRS issued a notice and a rather lengthy set of frequently asked questions that deal with qualified small employer health reimbursement accounts. Those are things added by the 21st Century Cures Act, effectively to allow small companies to pay for an employee's private insurance policy. We'll talk about, you know, what's in that document and why probably if you're working with a client who's trying to set up one of these programs, you may want to consult that document. But let's start this week with where we've been the last few weeks, and let's talk about what Congress is up to. We're still talking about the bill, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, H.R. 1. We left you last week. The Senate Finance Committee had finished their work. Well, kind of finished their work. They had finished, unlike the House, they didn't actually have a bill text they were working from. The House, when they started their process, started with a bill text, and all amendments were amendments to the bill text. The Senate started with a description of what they planned to get to, and they kept amending the description. Now that they've approved that description, it was on Tuesday of this week, well, late Monday night, the Senate actually got finished, the Senate staff did, they're still in town, even if the senators aren't, got finished the actual bill. 415-page Senate bill was released, so if you want to take a look at the Senate bill, we now have a way to look at that, 415 pages of Senate bill. One thing I want to mention that I hadn't mentioned last week regarding something in the Senate bill is an item that initially I kind of scanned by because you have to edit some. We can't talk about everything in detail. But you probably should be aware, especially if you have audited financial statements that you're prepared for your company, or you're in public accounting and some of your clients do have audited statements or are filing with the SEC. This bill is going to add a provision, the Senate version, not the House, that would require companies to report revenue essentially based on timing that agrees with their applicable financial statement. Now that term's going to be used, it's going to have the same basic meaning it had when we talked about the rules for capitalization. Remember, to make a de minimis election, it's important if you have an applicable financial statement. If you have that same thing using the same sort of test, then your timing for reporting your income on your tax return is going to have to be the same as the timing for reporting on that AFS. This is scored as actually raising money because, of course, a lot of public companies like to show, you know, public companies love to show income, right? That's what Wall Street likes to look at. So there is this idea the Senate has that what companies are doing is being more aggressive, shall we say, in reporting income for GAAP purposes, and then being much more conservative in reporting their income for tax purposes, so they're going to make the two come out equal. Now, this would not apply necessarily if you don't have an AFS, except the law as written by Congress would allow the IRS to write regulations to deal with taxpayers who don't have AFSs and what sort of reporting they'd have to have. This could get a little more interesting. You may want to keep your eye on this. They also codify the advance payment method that currently you elect. Remember the one where if you get an advance payment, we don't have to recognize as income any faster than we do under GAAP, but we can't delay more than 1 year. They would codify that rule. Now, again, this is not in the House bill. This is only in the Senate bill. But it is important to keep an eye on this. This could cause us some issues, and especially with the changes coming up in revenue recognition for GAAP purposes. Anyway, this could get very interesting if we have these timings coming the same way for both. But let's go back to the bill now. We'll take a look where we're at. We do expect amendments to come up this week. So the Senate's going to try to move to 50 votes. Currently, there is no hard count I know of yet, or anybody has yet put together or tried to put together a hard count. You know, obviously, obviously there are discussions we can assume are going on with Senate leadership to try to get a feeling for what it's going to take to get a hard count where we get at least 50 members to say, yes, this is fine. And we're also assuming that nothing has changed, and we're still looking at having to get these 50 from the 52 Republican senators, therefore meaning we can only have two defectors who do not vote for the bill. Now, there are a series of senators who have voiced certain reservations with the bill, but nobody has yet really come out and said absolutely they won't vote for it at all. The closest is Ron Johnson, who claims he'll vote against it in its current form, but he has indicated that he's not against the concepts in general, so if you make a few changes, he'd be happy. We're not totally sure how much of a change we need to make to make Senator Johnson happy. We also have a couple of other senators. Some senators are concerned about the effects on the deficit, especially when the fact that a lot of these things that are being, you know, that are ending, we know we're having to these things that sunset after a few years, the concept being that we're being assured that they won't really sunset, and now that's got the deficit people upset, well, they don't really sunset, then what does that mean for the deficit? So that could get a little interesting. You know, we may have some other issues arise as to why people are upset about it. But in any event, keep your eyes on it. Probably the deficit hawks are the most significant risk to this bill at this point. So we'll have to see what has to be done to satisfy at least enough of those to get the 50 votes, and then what goes on with the Senate and House. That brings us to another point. After we finish this, we technically go to conference normally. But there's a pretty good article in Tax Analyst that'll publish on Monday. And I say it publishes on Monday. The way it works with Tax Analyst, if you subscribe to Tax Notes, is we've all known for quite a while that they always put Monday's edition is actually the last thing they do on Friday. Normally, this week was the last thing done on Wednesday. So we've been able to see this for a while. There's a pretty good article there that discusses the options there. And I've heard this from a couple of other sources too, that it's highly likely there will not be a conference. Rather, there will be an agreement between the leadership of the House and Senate about what's going to be in the final bill. Then there will be a manager's amendment offered in the Senate that would basically strike everything in the Senate bill, replace it with the manager's amendment, which would have what they'd agreed is going to be the compromise bill. And then the manager's amendment would be passed by the Senate, would go back to the House, who would pass that bill. It would bypass the conference committee. They want to bypass conference for a couple of reasons. Number one, there are a lot of procedural issues that get in the way to get conference out of the Senate. Number two, to do that, you've got to appoint members. And since they're not planning to have any Democratic votes, it's kind of a waste of time to spend time appointing Democratic members, but they would end up doing that. They have to hold conference time. And basically, the concept is here they might want to avoid the conference entirely. That's definitely been done in other cases. The budget vote this year was one where they avoided conference entirely by having the Senate pass a bill that would then the House would just rubber stamp on the way back through. We'll probably see something very similar with this bill. Well, let's go on to some developments now, since we've actually got some time this week to do them. First, we're going to look at here is Private Letter Ruling 2017-43011. This one came out on October the 27th. Yeah, we've been tied up with tax reform recently and all explaining what's all in those bills. So now we need to talk a little bit about something that goes back a little ways. This was a case of a retiree who began to receive payments from his retirement account. And he did this for a number of years, but it became aware that his payments were actually higher than they should have been. Now, this was a plan where he had made some contributions that were of a pre-tax nature. So because of that, you know, his pre-tax contributions, he'd been recovering bases. In fact, he'd been recovering bases using the safe harbor method of reporting that you find under Notice 88118. Well, that's all fine, but, you know, here's the problem. He'd been overpaid. Under the plan, there was an arrangement where if you were overpaid, you met certain requirements that you could be excused from having to return that overpayment. And this particular beneficiary met the requirements to be excused from having to return that overpayment to the plan. But the catch was the plan was going to issue a Form 1099-C to the taxpayer to document the fact that, you know, he did not have to report that overpayment. Well, that's kind of a problem because that's cancellation of debt form. So they went back, got this private letter ruling. In the ruling, the IRS ruled in a way the taxpayer wanted that, in fact, because he had been previously reporting all this income, and remember, under that safe harbor rule of that notice, you determine how many months you'd recover your payment over if you qualify for that, and then you basically recover a fixed amount per month. As the IRS notes, effectively, you know, he would still have the same recovery, so he's not really going to get a benefit from this. He had therefore over-reported his income by the amount of the cancellation of debt. And on the flip side of this, if he had to pick that up, he'd effectively be double paying the tax. Because of that, the IRS agreed in this fact circumstance, despite the issuance of a 1099-C, there is no cancellation of debt income. Next up, we're going to take a look at Announcement 2017-15. This was issued on Halloween. And it, as I noted to start the broadcast, not unexpectedly expanded the retirement plan relief previously granted to hurricane victims in the hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. We went ahead and expanded those special rules for qualified plans to the victims of the California wildfires. As with Hurricane Maria and Maria, Harvey, Irma, in this case, it does include ways that plans can be more liberal in dealing with hardship distributions and plan loans. It allows plans, now your plan has to be one that's allowed to make hardship distributions, but even if you're missing the language, you can start doing it under these if they relate to the wildfires. You also don't have to cause people to stop making contributions to hardships. That's normally not allowed, but in this case, especially meets these requirements. And there's less due diligence that has to be done. You know, you can take people's word for the fact that they have expenses due to the wildfires unless you happen to know they're lying. So either a hardship distribution or a plan loan, you still have to meet certain requirements. But if your plan does not allow for hardship distributions or plan loans, but you have participants who were impacted by the California wildfires, who were in the counties that were impacted by it, you can have these special provisions added. Again, the rules are the same as we discussed a few weeks ago, actually many weeks ago, going back to Hurricane Harvey. It's the same basic set of rules, same issue, this time, though, granted to the California wildfire victims. Let's move on to a tax court case in this case, and this is an S-Corp case where somebody got a little bit creative. This is the case of Smith versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-218. This case came down on November the 6th. Taxpayer in this case had a problem that some of our clients from time to time have. They were going to recognize a lot of income in the year in question, and they really didn't want to pay tax on that income. So they started looking for advisors, and they talked about advisors, and they come on a lot of income, so they're doing some estate planning too. And they talked to this advisor who said, you know, we probably should set up a family limited partnership for estate planning. And I got an even better idea. We're going to go ahead and we're going to use this flip to be able to reduce your income taxes. Now, you might start thinking and saying, well, you know, we're going to use a family limited partnership, but how does that going to reduce our income taxes? I mean, you gift that, so we know the discounts we get for gifting. But the income is going to flow through that for the shares we retain. Obviously, the amount we gift won't. But none of that would normally allow us to offset this really big amount of income. Well, this advisor had an idea. He said, you know, we've been down this road to do this all the time with estate plans, and we do a family limited partnership. And when you put the assets in there, you know, you take let's say you take $1 million worth of assets, you put them in a family limited partnership, and suddenly they come out, and the valuations tells us that these assets are now worth, let's say, 60%. So we had $1 million worth of assets, and now When we get around to gifting them, suddenly the gifts are going to total up to only $600,000. And saying, you know, we could probably, you know, why can't we use that for income tax purposes, that decrease in value? We just had to figure out how to realize that. Well, we had a way to do so. The taxpayers in this case were to contribute their family to partnership interest that they retained to an S corporation that they formed. So the S corporation is formed. We contribute the family limited partnership shares to the S corp. The documentation tells us, now they tried to argue they were thinking of maybe keeping it around, but it was pretty obvious from the letters written that at the very beginning, the S corporation was going to be dissolved in the same year that the family limited partnership interest went in. Why? Well, let's think about this. Under 351, the family limited partnership interest goes in at the taxpayer's basis. Let's say that their interest was, or was a, let's say their retained interest was, ignoring discounts, $1 million. So they had $1 million of basis because they put that in. They had that $1 million in basis they put into the S corporation. We then turn around and distribute that flip. We make that flip interest contribute to the S corp. So we have the, you know, 351. We still retain the same basis in it. But now when we dissolve the S corp, suddenly at that point, well, we don't recognize a loss at the S level. We understand that. But we do turn our shares in. Remember, our basis in our shares was $1 million. We now get back $600,000 in value. Well, that's a $400,000 capital loss, right? Well, maybe. On paper, it looks great. Actually, they were trying to argue it was an ordinary loss, too, but they had conceded by trial there was no way to get that to ordinary. But they tried to claim that large capital loss. The tax court, though, would have none of it. The court said very simply there was no economic substance to the S corporation. The S corporation was formed with the full intention of dissolving it. They had tried to paper this over by claiming they were going to use it for various purposes. The court said, look, it doesn't make sense. Had you used it for that purpose, we don't believe you really meant to anyway. And had you used it for that purpose, this loss would never have been generated. You were doing this. There was no reason to wrap the flip inside of an S except to generate this loss. So it seemed we don't believe this concept that you're really going to try to do something for business and it just didn't work. We're going to rather say we think that in reality, what really happened in this case was you just, you know, wanted to get this big loss on the return. You tried to use the discount. Doesn't work. Now, you might wonder, well, but why does it work for estate tax purposes? That's because you're dealing with a very different set of rules and laws. On estate tax, when somebody dies, all that the estate tax law allows the IRS to do is tax the value transferred at death. And the gift tax is the same, value transferred. What's transferred is based on property. And we have a long series of cases, and this gets, I remember hearing Stacy Eastland many years ago give the constitutional law description. I am not a constitutional law person by any stretch of the imagination. But the argument is that the U.S. Constitution basically requires them to respect the state law definition of property in that case because you're not dealing with something like the income tax law that has a, where we have a constitutional amendment structure stuck on top that allows them to tax this way. So for that reason, the recognition has to be there for the estate tax and gift tax. But for income taxes, that's not true. And in this case, as we said, it just didn't work. The court blew it out of the water instantly. Well, that wasn't the only S corporation problem we had in the cases coming down. We also had the case of Messina versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-213, dated October 30, 2017. This case goes way back, and I mean, this is what I remember when I first started doing live CPE sessions. Just before that, I had written an article that it dealt with a case called Ruckreigel. And Ruckreigel is a very similar fact pattern to what we see in Messina. Here's the catch in this case. This is a problem of S corporation debt. Messina and another person, we have a couple of taxpayers in this. They held an interest in an S corporation that had bought a casino. That S corporation that owned the casino, they actually still had, as minority interest holders in the S corporation, the former owners of the casino that had sold the casino to them. Under the terms of their agreement with the buyers, with the sellers, because they were still paying them, Any amounts that these gentlemen, Messina and the other gentlemen, loaned that S Corporation had to be subordinated to the loan due to these sellers. Now, not surprisingly, as often happens with the purchase of a business, things don't go as well as the buyers hope they would. And the buyers start to think, as they often will, whether it's correct or not, that the sellers had kind of deceived them about how wonderful things were. So they're not happy with the sellers. They also have a debt now that's coming up for refinancing. The company's not doing as well. So they don't want to give up on the casino, but they're not sure this debt's one they want to let be financed in the market because the interest rates are going to get much higher. So they wanted to loan the money to the S Corporation and refinance this debt on their own. But the problem was they didn't want the subordination. So their attorney told them, if you form a new corporation and have that corporation make the loan to the S Corp, the way the documents are written, that attorney took the position that the subordination clause would not come into place and that, in fact, this debt would not have to be subordinated and they'd be unable to receive any principal out of it until the sellers had been paid off. So they did that. They formed this brand new S Corporation. They made the loan to the Q Sub, which held the casino, and that much all is well. But the casino was losing money. They attempted to claim losses using the loan as basis. And they're thinking, well, look, economically, we really loaned money. We took money out of our pockets. It ends up in the S Corporation. Don't we get credit for that? Well, there's no question that based on substance over form that you could say that seems to be obvious. Yes, the real substance was they loaned money to the S Corp. But the problem in S Corporation loans is form basically takes precedence over substance. In this case, the problem is under the law, you have to loan money directly from the shareholders to the S Corp. If you go through a related party, this was a related S Corp in the Ruckreigel case, which goes back over a decade. Ruckreigel, it was a partnership that was loaning money to the S Corp. And it doesn't matter. You can't say you control it. You can't ignore it. The loan has to come from the shareholders. When it doesn't come from the shareholders, you don't get basis. In fact, as the court pointed out in this case, because they had loaned money to the other S Corp, really that's basis in the other S Corp. And we're not going to let you count it twice. You know, they ignored their claims. They tried to claim that, well, you know, you should ignore that S Corp. It was merely acting as an agent. And the court said, no, you had these forms. And no, it wasn't just, you know, this thing to be ignored. You got something out of it. You avoided subordination. There was a real business reason for having the second S Corp. And frankly, you just can't get basis for loaning money from a related party to the S Corp. That just doesn't work. That's not how these things work in this case. Finally, let's take a look at the IRS issued notice 2017-67. The IRS issued a set of frequently asked questions, and this is a rather long document, about 59 pages, of questions and answers related to this thing called a qualified small employer health reimbursement arrangement. And that the QSEHRA is the acronym they're using. I have no idea how you'd pronounce that. Normally try to make pronounceable acronyms. That's just, you know, what we're going to call it, QSERA. Who knows how you'd refer to that. But it was added last year in the 21st Century Cures Act, passed just before the end of December. You may remember that bill. In that bill, Congress was dealing with a problem created by the Affordable Care Act. A lot of small employers had been paying for their employees' private health insurance premiums because they were either unable to get a group policy or, you know, the cost for a group policy was way higher than their employees been able to buy policies on the open market. So because of that, Congress set up this, you know, that was great, except under the Affordable Care Act, as interpreted by the IRS and Department of Labor and Health and Human Services, you weren't allowed to do that. In essence, employers had to get their coverage from the group market in order to be offering a qualified plan. Otherwise, the IRS had ruled that such a program would violate various provisions of the Affordable Care Act, due to limitations. You were only going to give people the amount to pay the insurance. You're not allowed to have limits on your plan. That was a limitation of your plan because the insurance was actually personal and outside the plan. So because of that, if you did that, the IRS interpretation was you owed a penalty, and the penalty wasn't small. It's $100 per day per affected employee. So it was going to be a rather expensive provision, you know, $36,500 expensive per employee. And while insurance premiums have gone up, that's not just a minor addition to the insurance premiums to pay $36,500. So generally, those plans were shut down. We had certain relief provisions passed. We had other issues come up. S Corporation shareholders have had relief now for a while because the IRS has never done anything else, but you had to limit those 2% shareholders. In the 21st Century Cures Act, which we discussed last year when it passed, Congress added this option where, to a limited extent, by the way, the amount you can reimburse is relatively small, so you have to be careful there because you're going to get just around, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 of reimbursement, depending upon whether it's a single plan or a family plan. But you could do that reimbursement, you could offer it to the employees, so they opened up a way to do it. But there were a lot of rules Congress put in, and some of these were subject to interpretation about what you can and can't do. Well, the IRS this week, or the IRS should say at the end of October, issued a 59-page document that has a series of questions and answers that tell us how we deal with these programs, with this program, to get one that doesn't, that is qualified under these rules. If you are working, now up until now, and basically it tells us this thing doesn't apply before and it applies to tax years beginning after this thing was issued. So for 2017, as long as you tried reasonably to comply with Congress's rules, the employer shouldn't be in trouble. But for 2018, you need to comply with this set of frequently asked questions. So if you have a client who did set up one of these programs and has been paying for private insurance premiums, you probably want to go get this thing. As I said, it's 59 pages. You're going to need to go through the questions and answers. Obviously, many of these questions will not apply to your client, so you can drop those. But the ones that do, you want to verify that their program doesn't have problems compared to the IRS's interpretation based on this set of frequently asked questions in Notice 2017-67. Remember, we need to get these things together. Since most of these are calendar year plans, you're going to need to get this all in place and corrected essentially within a little more than a month from today. You have to get everything in place to go. So if you've not gone and checked with clients on this issue, if you have clients doing this sort of thing, make sure you take a look at this particular set of questions and answers. Take a look, make sure your client is not running afoul of any of the rules in here, and get them ready so in 2018 they can start with a proper set of rules for a plan like this, because you don't meet these requirements, you're back to that $100 a day penalty problem, because you have to come under this to avoid the prior interpretation. And as we probably are all aware, while Congress is talking about zeroing the individual penalty, they're not talking about currently doing anything else about the Affordable Care Act. So these rules stay in place for next year, so you better make sure your client's not violating them, because that could get expensive if the IRS decided to enforce these things. Well, it's that, as I said, it's December coming up, and I want to say I'm going to be going this week, and I'll see some of you people. I'm going to be off to Tulsa, Oklahoma, do the Oklahoma Tax Institute there. I've been doing that institute since, I believe, 1999. And this year, for the first time in a number of years, I'm going back to the topic I started with there. We'll be talking about technology. Well, I'll do a tax topic, too, in a breakout. But the one I'm going to do for the general session is going to talk about technology, specifically how CPAs get themselves in, how CPAs may be exposed to, you know, issues as far as attacks on your network, and what your responsibilities are to try to protect your client data, either your network, items in the cloud, all those neat things. We'll talk about that. We'll deal with those issues. I'll also then be going on to Minnesota, and I'll be doing there that huge conference at the Minnesota Convention Center, one of the largest in the country for CPAs, tax conference, at the Minneapolis Convention Center. I'll be doing two sessions there, so I'll have my para sessions in those cases. So I'll be for people that week. The following week, I'll be doing a tax session, a session in Albuquerque on S corporations, actually, which will be a session at their tax conference. I'm going to be all over tax conferences the next 2 weeks, be all over the place there. Also do a class in Albuquerque just for fun that week. So I have those things going. And then I close out this year in Boise, Idaho, which we're going to talk about the partnership audit rules. I have a course that's mainly devoted to those rules, fundamentally. So if you're having to do with partnership audits, take a look at that. And also have a general pass-through course. We'll try to deal with all the other stuff that deals with pass-throughs besides what we had to deal with partnership audits and advanced issues on the first day with partnerships. And then I'm scheduled after that to go on to Miami, Florida, where I'll talk about real estate partnerships. Loads of fun thing to do. We'll talk about that and do a day of current federal tax developments. Then back to Phoenix, going to do ethics in Arizona and Arizona taxes, along with another set of current federal tax developments. And then I'm done for this calendar year. We'll start back up in January doing a couple of other things. But if you guys are available, you're out there, you can come by and see me. You want to talk while I'm there. The only rule is in Tulsa, catch me after the first session, because after the second session, I'm rushing to the airport to get to Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, I don't have nearly as much of a rush to get back to the airport to get back to Phoenix. But unfortunately, the timing is kind of tight doing two tax conferences. So getting from Tulsa to Minneapolis is going to be a little bit more fun. So get me after the first session in Tulsa. But I look forward to seeing you guys if you're there. Otherwise, I'll be back here next week, and we'll talk about what in the world Congress has come up with for what's happening in this structure. So we'll take a look at this, and actually it is the week of November 27th. For those of you looking on the screen, it says 23rd. No, 23rd, wrong day. 27th is our date. So we'll be there, and we'll talk to you about what's going on in taxes. You can catch our updates on the web. We put them at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Expect Congress to get acting yet again on the tax bill, so we'll see what we've got. Hey, who knows? We could even be very lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it. We might have a tax bill by next week. We'll see, because, again, if, in fact, we get this manager's amendment, which is the compromise bill, then this could move very quickly. We'll see how fast it really goes. Make sure you check your State Society of CPAs website for all the full-day courses we're going to be offering in the coming few weeks. Got a lot of those here. A lot of you are getting your CP for the next few weeks, so you want to make sure to check out your live CP. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @edzollers, as new things come up, as things go, as I post things to the website. We'll actually put it out there on the Twitter feed, so you can find out there right away. But otherwise, you know, hey, we got a week. Congress comes back in session. By this time next week, will we have a tax law? Probably not, but you never know at this point because we're getting ready. So in any event, make sure you tune in next week. You know, pick up this wherever you get it. And we'll check in, see what's happened in the area of federal taxes in this coming week as we head into the month of December, getting ready to close out the year.